The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With the all-new Nissan Juke. The coupe crossover by Nissan. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
I mentioned the Mother and Baby Homes report, which we'll talk about in a political context in a few minutes, but we spoke about it at great length here on this show and other shows last week. And it was comforting in those conversations to think of the people who perpetrated such awful acts in those homes. And I don't have to go through those acts or give examples because we all heard them at length last week. But it's comforting to think of the people who perpetrated them as somehow bad or somehow evil. But could that really be true for all of those people? Thousands worked in those homes. Tens of thousands worked with the people in those homes. Hundreds of thousands knew about those homes. And so to help us understand or answer the questions about what makes someone who may be perfectly rational and perfectly empathetic in other walks of life carry out some of these acts or order some of these acts or stand over some of these acts, I'm joined by Brendan Kelly, who's a professor of psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin. Brendan, it's a pleasure to speak to you and we appreciate your time here on the show. Firstly, can I just ask about that, this idea and this narrative, I suppose, that generates itself after something like this happens, that all of the people involved are somehow bad or somehow evil?
Well, Kieran, we are all capable of acts of great kindness and also acts of great coldness and callousness and cruelty. Our circumstances and events dictate what we do to an enormous extent. So, you know, it's perfectly possible that people who are very good, very well-intentioned and believe they are doing the right thing can, at the time or indeed in retrospect, be seen to have done things that were indeed very cruel or, as you say, evil. We are all capable of such acts, depending on the circumstances we find ourselves in.
So is it a case of kind of there but for the grace of God go I when we're talking about these people?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, we can see certain factors and things we can look out for. So, for example, people sometimes develop tunnel vision where they can only see, you know, maybe their own context or what they're doing, and they have an absolute belief that they are correct. And you see this sometimes in, particularly, it has to be said, in religion, when people develop a definitive and absolute belief that does not permit of any wavering. And this absolutism, no matter what direction it's in, be it religious, be it political, be it something else, this absolutism or dogmatism can be used as a way of rationalizing acts that are in themselves, you know, unthinkable if you take them out of their context. So that development of tunnel vision, particularly in a religious context, but also a political context or a social context, can lead to acts of great cruelty, either through commission, things that were done, and we've heard a lot of those, or also acts of omission, onlooker effects, where you simply believe that what other people are doing is okay.
The fact that they need to rationalise it to themselves, or if one is carrying out one of these acts or standing by and let it being carried out, the fact that you need to rationalise it, does that indicate that on some level you do accept that it's wrong?
Well, yes. I mean, we suspend our judgment a little bit sometimes, but particularly when there's pressure to conform. If you belong to a group that is a very tight group with a lot in common and then a lot that is different to other people, you tend to develop group beliefs and you rationalize in that context. So the example here, of course, would be, say, an order of nuns or an order of monks or any really small, tight group that there's this huge pressure to conform. It is difficult not to conform, and you start to rationalize things so that you don't have to object to what you and other people are doing. And the other very powerful force that allows people to commit these acts is when it's reinforced. So when, for example, the mother and baby homes were of the view that they were serving a social function that nobody else wanted to serve, and they felt their actions were endorsed by society, local authorities, communities and society, that too is a very powerful driver to keep people doing things that they might not otherwise do.
Does it become easier then, like once it's reinforced over and over again, does that rationalization, the need for it, become less because we begin to accept what we're doing?
Well, we do, and we start to we fail to see the need to stop. And when you add to this, I suppose the one of the final elements in this particular story is the idea of obedience to authority, which is something that is very strong in many religions and indeed many organizations that function on obedience. But it is a particular principle in certain religions. And when you add that to the mix, to the, you know, to the reinforcement that happens, to the pressure to conform and to the tunnel vision of absolute beliefs, then any of us in those circumstances are liable to commit acts that can seem cruel at the time and can certainly seem so in retrospect as well.
But that obedience, though, to authority, to what extent is religion unintentionally, you know, religion exploiting an element of human psychology? To what extent, even outside of the experience of religion, are we just programmed as people, as kind of gregarious animals, to follow a social order, a pecking order?
Well, we do find consolation, in rules. Basically, we love a good set of rules. We know this in relation to children, that children do better when there is a clear set of guidelines about how they behave at school, how they behave at home, and so forth. And they might violate those from time to time. But ultimately, the child is happier when there is a clear set of rules and protocols and procedures, and they thrive on that. We do that as well as adults. And one of the attractions of many religious orders is this idea of obedience and submitting oneself to a set of rules, to something bigger. There's a sense of belonging. There's often a sense of relief. But that can lead to blind obedience and the tunnel vision that can lead us down pathways we would not otherwise go down.
There is that famous, and I can't remember the name of it. It was carried out I think it was at Yale University, this mm-hmm. experiment where people were asked essentially to electrocute one of their classmates in another room. And some of them, and you might have more detail on this, or you'll understand it more than I. Essentially, when someone in authority tells them to keep turning up the dial, they kept doing it.
Yes, we are capable of these acts when we are told by people in authority to do things. And this is evident all over the world. I mean, this was evident in sort of some of the notorious prisons that have existed, where torture and cruelty was carried out on by orders from authorities. And sometimes even the law permits people to do difficult things. If you look at countries with capital punishment, what happens there is someone who executes a prisoner is doing this killing, because it is permitted by law. And they regard that as allowing them to commit an act which is in itself, most people would not do. Indeed, mostly the person who is being executed is being executed for killing someone. But it's the authority, the government, the law that permits this. It allows people to suspend their individual moral judgment, at least that's how they feel, and they can go ahead and do acts. And that happens to a much lesser extent, of course, in the case of religious orders or other institutions that manage people.
The Milgram experiment is what my producer has told me. So if anyone is wondering what I'm talking about, Google it. It's absolutely fascinating what went on there. It was in Yale University. To what extent then as well, Brendan, is psychology at play when we begin to paint these characters not as rational actors trying to rationalize bad behavior, but as simply bad people? That it provides comfort to us on the outside looking in to think of them as almost kind of two-dimensional creatures.
We do struggle with complexity, and we are very fond of good and evil. That's for sure. It helps us make sense of the world clearly. And we struggle sometimes to have a more complex construct and say that the religious orders need to stand up and take responsibility for their part in this, which was very substantial. And the state needs to take responsibility for its part. But neither religious orders nor the state are entirely divorced from the society that generates them. You know, we elect the politicians that make the government, and the politicians in power at the time were elected again and again and again. While some of the explanations offered by religious orders do not hold water, it is a fact that that they were at the time seen as solving what was wrongly regarded as a social problem that other people did not want. Now, even that language indicates how wrongly people thought about this issue at the time. But the fact is, we find comfort in painting, in assigning responsibility very precisely, whereas in fact, religious orders bear a lot of responsibility for actions that were taken, things that were done and undone, as does the state and as does everyone else who was only too willing to look away.
Well, you've kind of touched on a question a texter asks here. All of this may apply within the homes themselves, but what explanation is there for those who put their daughters in or those family members who left them there? Is this back to the rationalization that they convinced themselves they were doing the right thing?
Well, yes. And I mean, one of the real issue for the state, if you like, is two issues about why were the homes as they were? It's so large, so cruel. But the second issue is, why were there no alternatives for the women or for the families who might have been hesitant about, you know, cooperating with the mother and baby home system? We see the same with other institutions all the time. If you take the psychiatric hospitals, the mental hospitals, which in the 1960s had about 20,000 people in them in Ireland, each of those had a family, and many of them would have kept their person at home if they had been supported to do so, but they weren't given any alternatives other than the institution. And this is a recurring problem as we tell these stories. And what's interesting about the mental hospitals, Kieran, if I may, is that the church was not involved in them at all. Irish society was perfectly capable of institutionalizing vast numbers of people without the involvement of the church.
Someone has texted in here, does the professor believe, though, that some people are just born bad?
No, I don't believe people are born intrinsically bad. I do think some people are born with a tendency to do more bad things than other people. But circumstances have a very large role to play. And there are some people who are or become psychopaths. These are people who lack empathy and can engage in acts of kindness or acts of cruelty in a perfectly equal way. They don't see a difference between the two. They don't feel a difference. However, this is very, very rare. And most people's bad acts are attributable to their life course and to their circumstances.
Brendan Kelly, Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin. Brendan, we really appreciate your time here on The Hard Shoulder. I found that absolutely fascinating. Maybe I should have said as well at the outset that this is in no way a discussion by way of attempt to excuse what happened in any of these homes. Rather, it was to try and understand why people who maybe are perfectly rational and perfectly good people in other aspects of their life could do such awful things, and undeniably awful they were. We are not engaging in revisionism here. But Brendan, like I said, we appreciate your time here on The Hard Shoulder.